My name is Andrew Geller, and I am very pleased to be speaking today with Ralph Nader. He is a longtime author, lecturer, attorney, and political activist, and his latest book is called Unstoppable: The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Welcome, Ralph.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Please tell us how you view the term convergence as it relates to the political system.
Yeah, well, when you deal with specific issues rather than generalized ideologies, people back home around the country are more likely to agree because they live, they work, they raise their children, and if there's a waste dump that's contaminating their water, there's no Republican or Democrat split there. It's just people want to protect their children. And so in this book, Unstoppable, the subtitle tells the theme of the book, the emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state. And basically what's involved is corporations, the big global corporations, just have too much power. And they have obviously huge power on government, elections. They're strategically planning, which is what their nature is. You know, the nature of our food, the educational subjects that are often taught. They're planning our tax system, our military budget. They have great influence on foreign policy. They're planning the commercialization of marketing directly to children, bypassing parental authority. And it just goes on and on. And I saw over the years that when people's sense of fair play is offended, their sense of the golden rule, their sense of this isn't right, they get together regardless of whether they're voting Republican or Democrat. And I see this as the major realignment politically in our country over the next 10 years to turn our country around. And more specifically, I've documented in this book, whenever left-right gets together, they are an unstoppable force in Congress and elsewhere. We've worked left and right to get the federal whistleblowers bill through overwhelmingly over a year ago. That gives federal employees the protection to blow the whistle on corporate fraud on Medicare, corporate fraud on defense contracts, et cetera. The corporations fought it to the limit, but they lost. And they lost with the False Claims Act in 1986 that saved tens of billions of dollars in terms of government being defrauded in various programs by corporate crime. And I've seen it just recently, as the U.S. was moving toward plunging into another war in Syria, millions of emails flew out of left-right in the United States to senators and congressmen, and they backed off real fast. The corporatists that have their hooks into our politicians and, of course, are symbolized by Wall Street against Main Street, the corporatists are terrified of left-right alliances. That's why they work overtime to divide the left and right, get them to focus on the areas where the left and right do disagree, like reproductive rights and gun control, et cetera, so that they don't, left and right, don't turn and really turn into a political force the major areas that they do agree on, altering our trade agreements, NAFTA, changing the Liberty-Restricting Patriot Act, which allows government snooping, going into your library records, going into your homes for search without notifying you for 72 hours, cracking down on Wall Street, that comes in 90%, breaking up the big banks who are deemed too big to fail because they're putting Wall Street still in a speculative binge with these derivatives, that comes in over 90%. So why isn't it moving faster? Because people haven't sensed the power of it yet. They're fighting each other on these other divisive issues that they do disagree on. Once they lock arms, though, back at the community level and then get press as a result, and then the politicians take notice and the polls swing in, it's unstoppable. And I have a very specific guide as to how to get this underway in a bigger way than it already is. You have Ron Paul, when he was a congressman, connecting with Congressman Barney Frank, a left Democrat, a libertarian Republican, in a caucus to challenge the bloated military budget. There's a left-right.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there is broad public support for a wide array of progressive perspectives and political actions. But as you point out early in the book, It's a vanishingly small number of people who actually oppose and work to prevent the realization of some of these goals. Why is such an extraordinarily small number of people so effective at halting the possibility of these alliances?
Because they represent huge economic interests, like the oil industry, the banking industry, the drug industry. So while, as you say, there are only a few thousand of these people lobbying in Washington, they give money to members of Congress. They hire them when the members of Congress quit, or they hire their relatives in nice paying jobs. The corporations get their nominees confirmed to head the government agencies and departments themselves, like the Treasury Department, Department of Defense, Food and Drug Administration, and Department of Interior. They work overtime because they get rich out of it. I mean, let's put it simply, the corporations and their bosses. But they are against basic American values and certainly against democratic values. You know, votes are supposed to count. They're not supposed to be nullified by pourings of money from commercial interests into the coffers of senators and representatives. So I see this book as a real discussion starter. There hasn't ever been a book written like this. It comes from my experience. It comes from reading conservative philosophers who have been mischaracterized by people like Congressman Paul Ryan. Most of these great conservative philosophers, from Adam Smith to Edmund Burke to Friedrich Hayek to Ludwig von Mises to more recently Peter Viereck and Russell Kirk, they all agreed that there has to be a social safety net. They hated, you know, government takeover of the economy or socialist planning of the economy, but they agreed there had to be public works, public facilities. Frederick Hayek, who is the guru for Paul Ryan, who adores Hayek, was against Medicare and Medicaid. But what Mr. Ryan doesn't tell us is that Frederick Hayek of the Austrian School of Economics was against those two programs because they discriminated. They weren't universal. Mm-hmm. He wanted universal health care. And Peter Viereck, he wanted unions because he felt that was building a sense of community against workers. So we have this book's a lot of fun to read. It's not that long. It's for readers, thinkers, and doers who are really serious about our country's future. They're not part of the 24/7 entertainment world. They are serious about our country's future, and it only takes about 1% of them, backed by public opinion in every congressional district, to turn it around.
Well, I think you just brought up a really important point. And as the editor of the Review of Austrian Economics said of Friedrich Hayek, what Hayek has become to a lot of people is an iconic figure representing something that he didn't believe at all. And conservative philosophy has been almost 180 degrees twisted around in modern American politics so that they're very easy to misrepresent. Can you talk a little bit about how modern-day conservative politicians are not conservative in the sense that these philosophers of decades ago intended?
Yeah, very much so. The key distinction are people who masquerade as conservatives, but they're really corporatists. And corporatism, which Ron Paul and Rand Paul talk about all the time, corporatism is a political economic doctrine that says that corporations run by bosses, and the fewer and bigger the better, with global reach, that have no allegiance to our country other to control it or ship its jobs and industries to autocratic regimes abroad who know how to keep their 80 cents per hour workers in play, that these corporate bosses have basically turned capitalist principles upside down as they merge with government power and create what Franklin Delano Roosevelt called, President Roosevelt in 1938 in a message to Congress, fascism. That's the control of government by private economic forces. And I say turned capitalist principles upside down. Yeah, they have stripped their owners, the shareholders, and the mutual funds and pension funds of almost any power over their bosses. The bosses basically are the hired hands, but they're not accountable to their owners, who are told, if you don't like the way we're running this company, if you don't like how much we're paying ourselves, $15,000 an hour, beat it. Sell the shares. Get out. And they also turn capitalist principles on upside down by using political power to interfere and disadvantage smaller business in favor of the big banks and pharmaceutical companies and chemical companies and real estate interests, etc. So that's why this book, I think, has a very powerful message.
Now, you talk about a couple of different types of convergence that, two broad categories. There's the substantive type of convergence and then procedural. Could you explain the difference between the two and maybe give a quick example of each?
Yeah. The Bill of Rights are procedure, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from unlawful search and seizure. Freedom of information laws, such as in Oregon and all the other states and the federal government, the right to get information from your government about, you know, nursing home inspections, meat and poultry plant, secret research that's done for corporations, free subsidy payments for corporations like the crony capitalist material that the right-wing conservatives do not like. So that's procedural. Getting rid of secrecy in government, having standing to sue, and not being thrown out of court on this foolish medieval doctrine. Oh, you don't have standing to sue, therefore you can't sue, corruption in government. These are very, very important ways to get into court, to get into the legislature, to have a voice, and to have power. Substantive, we all know. I mean, a majority of people since Harry Truman proposed universal health insurance have supported full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, free choice of doctor and hospital, and much more efficient than the present wasteful, corrupt system. So we know substantive issues, consumer protection, protection of air, water, food, building public works for public facilities, repairing things on time, schools, roads, bridges, public transit, sewage and water systems. All this has huge left-right support. And it just occurred to me, Andrew, that the original left-right institution in this country are juries. They are picked rather randomly. I mean, they don't ask potential jurors, are you a lefty or a righty? Are you Republican or a Democrat? That's unheard of when the lawyers are trying to pick the jurors. And what we've seen is when these jurors come in really slapping the knuckles and holding these corporations accountable for people they have wrongfully injured or environment they have toxically poisoned, those are jury decisions, basically left-right jury decisions. They hear the facts, they read the law by the judge, and they come to a conclusion. This is a point that Greg Cafuri, a lawyer in Portland who you know, points out again and again, namely that when you get before a jury and you're dealing with evidence and the evidence can be challenged from both sides to get more veracity and the judge is in control of the courtroom to make sure the procedures are followed, the juries come out most often with the right verdict, and if they don't, they can be appealed to intermediate court and to the Oregon Supreme Court. But most of the time they come out with a right verdict that the judges deem right if they were deciding the facts. So, you know, let's get a morale builder here. When liberals go to try to change something, they don't think they can win in today's political climate of gridlock. When right-wing people or conservative people try to change something, they don't think they can win in the present gridlock and paralysis in Washington and a lot of other places in the country. But when liberals and conservatives, libertarians and progressives get together, they have a sense that victory is possible because they represent not only a majority, but they represent a perception by the lawmakers, which can be put in very colloquial language. Don't mess with this block. Don't mess with this alliance because you're going to lose. It's unstoppable.
Well, let's come back in a moment to the long history of these types of alliances. My name is Andrew Geller. I'm speaking with Ralph Nader. His latest book is Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. You talk a fair bit in the book about the 1930s as an example of maybe not always easy convergence between left and right, but an era in which it was far more prevalent than today. Could you describe that a little?
They called themselves decentralists. They were mostly Southern writers, reporters, poets, grassroots advocates, and they came together in so many different ways, and I have a whole chapter devoted to them, where they challenged power, they challenged government coercion, they challenged corporate coercion, they challenged all kinds of coercion that stripped people of their property and their rights. And I thought it was worth a chapter in the book, Unstoppable, because they were so much more sophisticated than most liberals and conservatives are today, so much more demanding of authentic democratic societies, so much more critical of the way corporations capture government. It's just a marvelous period of American history. And one reason they were so fundamental, Andrew, is because they lived and worked and were deprived with people during that terrible depression back in their hometowns and cities and in rural areas. So they saw it. They weren't theoretical think tanks in Washington, D.C. or New York or, you know, Los Angeles, you know, up there on the fifth or tenth story of a building, having good wages, salaries, bonuses, and pensions. These were people who were right down where the pain was. And so they were very empirical and very authentic. And we've got a lot to learn from them in the 1930s and the Depression.
After talking about that era in the book, you then talk a little bit about how the new left of the 1960s didn't have the same kind of historical, philosophical champions that modern conservatives do, setting guidelines and methods of tackling issues the way that conservatives had, and that liberals even ridiculed the progressives from the earlier generation. Can you describe a little bit about why you see that difference between the left and the right and kind of honoring the history from which they came?
Yeah, that's a very good point. You've really read this book, Andrew.
I read the book.
I think part of it is this. The tradition of conservatism is basically a philosophic one. And so they go back to the great conservative philosophers, like I mentioned, and political economists like Adam Smith and Edmund Burke and Friedrich Hayek, Fred Myers, Murray Rothbard, and so forth. And they're guided by them. These are the authentic conservatives, not the corporatists masquerading as conservatives. The liberals and progressive, on our understand, they don't have that intellectual tradition. They are much more empirical. Their forebears are the muckrakers, the expose book authors, people, you know, who exposed Standard Oil and people who exposed corporate corruption of the cities and corrupt city machines. And unfortunately, that isn't good enough. You have to have a philosophic network of thought in order to really motivate people. You motivate people with facts on the ground, self-interest, legitimate self-interest, and principles of justice, a coherence that really is very, very motivated. It's one reason why religion motivates people. One, not all the reasons, is it is a coherent explanation of life and afterlife. So, and then in the 60s, there was a cultural revolution, which led to this phrase, never trust anybody over 30. So the cultural revolution, sexual revolution, drugs, flair, music, all that went with it, tend to rupture the continuity from those great radicals in the 30s who really fought on the ramparts for the kind of proper regulations of Wall Street and the social safety net that gave birth to Social Security.
So you mentioning that quote, never trust anyone over 30, that became common in the 60s, made me just realize that, intentional or not, if you just do the simple arithmetic, they're targeting anybody who was born after the 30s.
That's right. And some of that attitude spilled over among the Occupy Wall Street people around the country. They just wouldn't listen to us, for example, when we said, look, on the you're in the encampments, you're getting mass media like crazy week after week in that fall, but it's not going to last. And when the police evicted them, they didn't have a base and they didn't get media anymore. But I said to them when they were in the encampments in Wall Street, Washington, elsewhere, and I spoke to 300 of them on a network telephone hookup, I said, go pick up the minimum wage issue. 30 million Americans will be grateful to you who are making now, you know, the people who clean up after us, who grow and harvest and serve our food, et cetera, who are making now less than American workers made in 1968, adjusted for inflation. Their minimum wage, federal, is still $7.25. If it was adjusted for inflation, it would be just under $11 an hour. Well, they said they weren't organized enough for it. Well, partly is because they didn't recognize the need for leadership. It's one thing not to have leaders manipulating mass movements, but not to have leadership. It doesn't have to be overwhelming leadership, you know, one guy at the top, but leadership in various strands of action. So it's very unfortunate that what happened. And part of it is not enough history. People don't know enough history, progressive history, the history of change, what blocks change. What's interesting, I debated Ronald Reagan years ago, and I got him to denounce corporate welfare, which the conservatives call crony capitalism. But when he became president, he let it happen, and it grew under his 8 years. I debated Milton Friedman once in Pittsburgh, and he was dead set against any regulation, any licensing, even licensing doctors. But he agreed that because you can't see, taste, smell, often pollution, and because there's no price on it, that it had to be regulated. So you see that even those two show the possibilities for a left-right alliance, which is now left-right behind solar energy, building up against the fossil fuel industry and the Koch brothers who are trying to surtax it at the state legislative level, and they're losing, the Koch brothers. They're losing. So you see it in a lot of areas, patenting of life forms. There's a left-right opposition to the Monsanto maneuvers. You see it in people who want shareholders to have more authority over runaway bosses and their huge compensation. You see it in more enforcement demanded on corporate crime, fraud and abuse against consumers, workers, shareholders, and the taxpayer. You see it against commercializing childhood and undermining parental authority, selling junk food and junk drink and violent programming. I spoke to evangelical audiences who were absolutely upset by this in terms of their own experience in raising their children. I mean, these are major areas. I had the libertarian longtime head of Cato Institute, Ed Crane. He said, Ralph, I oppose all corporate subsidies, unconstitutional wars, the Patriot Act's restrictions on our freedoms, and the Federal Reserve run amok. I said, that's a pretty good start, Ed. Mm-hmm. All this is in the book. The book is extremely motivating to anybody who's discouraged about the present and future of our country. I urge you not only to get it, to give it to your library, but to have living room discussions on it from time to time.
And it's the perfect kind of book to discuss with, say, your conservative relatives that you may see only at holidays. And, you know, there's a lot of books put out by people who are thought of as liberal progressive that conservatives would never think about reading. And possibly some of your past books would be in that camp. But this book really does allow for conservatives to, I guess, feel comfortable reading it because you're trying to include them.
Yeah, and I respect their basic philosophers of years ago. And I call out the corporatists who twist Adam Smith's Invisible Hand and the other philosophic icons into their own juggernaut against a authentic functioning democratic society where justice is preeminent.
So you started to discuss some of the 25 proposed redirections and reforms possible through convergence, and we only have a few minutes left. I would like to discuss briefly a couple more that you haven't mentioned, and I went through the list and just kind of thought about, well, which of these could theoretically be easy to accomplish as opposed to things that would take years and years like ending corporate personhood. That would obviously not be sort of something that the president could do via an executive order, or that Congress could just go, oh, yeah, this makes a lot of sense.
I think very briefly that some of these are going operational. There's left-right support for enhanced minimum wage. That comes in 70 to 80%. Conservative Walmart workers aren't going to say, I want to stay at $8 an hour because I'm conservative. That's moving now in cities, and it's moving in places from Seattle are pushing $15 an hour. You see that moving in states going ahead of the federal minimum wage, and it's now becoming an election issue at the national congressional level. The Democrats finally picked it up. I think it's going operational to stop further expansion of these job-destroying, sovereignty-shredding international trade agreements. It certainly has already gone in 22 states to stop eminent domain condemnation of homes to turn the property over to corporations. That was 22 states did that. That couldn't have been done by a left-right alliance. I think the challenging of direct marketing to children, even if it doesn't involve laws, can provide pretty good advances there. I think, you know, with the stopping the intervention in Syria without constitutional observance, I think we're coming to a rebellion in Congress against the leaders to stop unconstitutional wars. And I think when the Patriot Act comes up for revision in 2015, next year, you're going to see something other than a rubber stamp of that one, as occurred in two prior ratifications. And I think we're going to start, believe it or not, getting a left-right coalition on climate change. I think the droughts, the floods, the tornadoes, the massive science behind it is convincing more and more people that burning fossil fuels and other forms of greenhouse gases has got to be replaced by renewable solar, which reduces air pollution in your lungs on the ground, saves more money in your pocket, like a more fuel-efficient motor vehicle, and reduces the greenhouse gases, which if we don't do, we will be cursed by our descendants.
What about breaking up the big banks?
That one is overwhelming, but the banks have a huge grip now on Congress with their own people and congressional staffs and huge money pouring into Congress. That's going to take a while. But, you know, a few victories left-right will lead to more motivated victories by left-right. So we got to get this on the road. Some of it is already operational, as I've noted, state level, juvenile justice reform on excessive sentencing, et cetera. And now we have a right on crime group formed to join with progressives led by Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist, of all people. They want to do it because it's wasting billions of dollars with this prison industrial complex. So this is a way to get things done in this country, a new political realignment, to get these issues on the election table, on the political table, because once they're kept off the table, as they have been, then you don't get media, you don't get polls, you don't get any dynamics. So the first step is to get it on the table.
Ralph Nader is author of Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. He is a prominent author, lecturer, political activist, and attorney, and he joined us today from Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for your time today, Ralph.
Thanks, Andrew. And if you want an autographed copy, you can go to nader.org and get one and contribute it to a friend or a library.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, your audience.